He settled in, then turned his hand to the side with a curt gesture, palm up. A cryptic appeared beside him, forming as if from mist. This one wore a stiff robe like they did in Shadesmar, the head a lacy and intricate pattern somehow more fine and graceful than that of Shallan's pattern. The cryptic waved eagerly. Kaladin had heard that Wit was a lightweaver now, but he hadn't been surprised. He felt he'd seen Wit lightweave long ago. Regardless, he didn't act like he was in one of the Radiant Orders. He was just, well, Wit. "This story," Wit said, "is a meaningless one. You must not search for a moral. It isn't that kind of story, you see. It's the other kind of story." The cryptic held up a flute, and Kaladin recognized it. "Your flute," he said. "You found it?" "This is a dream, idiot," Wit said. "It's not real." "Oh," Kaladin said. "Right." "I'm real," the cryptic said with a musical, feminine voice. "Not imaginary at all. Unfortunately, I am irrational. Ha ha!" She began to play the flute, moving her fingers along it, and while soft music came out, Kaladin wasn't certain what she was doing to produce the sounds. She didn't have lips. "This story," Wit said, "is called The Dog and the Dragon." "The what and the what?" Kaladin said. "Or is this not the part where I speak yet?" "You people," Wit said. "A dog is a hound, like an axe hound." He held up his palm, and a creature appeared in it, four-legged and furry, like a mink, only larger, and with a different face shape. "It is funny, you can't realize," Wit said. "Humans will selectively breed for the same traits regardless of the planet they're on. But you can't be amazed at the convergent examples of domestication across the Cosmere. You can't know any of this, because you live on a giant ball of rock full of slime where everything is wet and cold all the time. This is a dog, Kaladin. They're fluffy and loyal and wonderful. This, on the other hand, is a dragon." A large beast appeared in his other hand, like a chasm fiend, except with enormous outstretched wings and only four legs. It was a brilliant, pearlescent color with silver running along the contours of its body. It also had smaller chitinous bits than a chasm fiend. In fact, its body was covered with little bits of carapace that looked smooth to the touch. It stood proud, with a prominent chest and a regal bearing. "I know of just one on Roshar," Wit noted, "and she prefers to hide her true form. This story isn't about her, however, or any of the dragons I've met. In fact, the dragon is barely in the story, and I'd kindly ask you not to complain about that part, because there's really nothing I can do about it, and you'll only annoy design." The cryptic waved again. "I get annoyed easily," she said. "It's endearing." "No, it's not," Wit said. "It's endearing," design said, "to everyone but him. I drew up a proof of it." The music continued playing as she spoke, and the way she moved her fingers on the flute seemed completely random. "One day, the dog saw the dragon flying overhead," Wit continued, sending the illusory dragon soaring above his hand. Kaladin was glad for the story. Anything to keep his attention off the hateful wind, which he could faintly hear outside, howling as if eager to rush into the bubble of light and assault him. "The dog marveled," Wit said, "as one might expect. He had never seen anything so majestic or grand. The dragon soared in the sky, shimmering with iridescent colors in the sunlight. When it curved around and passed above the dog, it called out a mighty challenge, demanding in the human tongue that all acknowledge its beauty." The dog watched this from atop a hill. Now, he wasn't particularly large, even for a dog. He was white, with brown spots and floppy ears, not of any specific breed or lineage, and small enough that the other dogs often mocked him. He was a common variety of a common species of a common animal that most people would rightfully ignore. But when this dog stared at the dragon and heard the mighty boast, he came to a realization. Today, he had encountered something he'd always wished for but never known. Today, he'd seen perfection and had been presented with a goal. From today, Nothing else mattered. He was going to become a dragon.
Hint, Design whispered to Kaladin. That's impossible. A dog can't become a dragon.
Design, Wit said, turning on her. What did I tell you about spoiling the end of stories?
Something stupid, so I forgot it, she said, her pattern bursting outward like a blooming flower.
Don't spoil stories, Wit said.
That's stupid. The story is really long. He needs to hear the ending so he'll know it's worth listening all the way.
That's not how this works, Wit said. It needs drama, suspense, surprise.
Surprises are dumb, she said. He should be informed if a product is good or not before being asked to commit. Would you like a similar surprise at the market? Oh, you can't buy a specific food. You have to carry a sack home, cut it open, then find out what you bought. Drama. Suspense.
Wit gave Kaladin a beleaguered look.
I have bonded, he said. A literal monster.
He made a flourish, and a light weaving appeared between them again, showing the dog on a hilltop covered in grass that looked dead since it didn't move. The dog was staring upward at the dragon, which was growing smaller and smaller as it flew away. The dog, Wit continued, sat upon that hilltop through an entire night and day staring, thinking, dreaming. Finally, he returned to the farm where he lived among others of his kind. These farm dogs all had jobs, chasing livestock or guarding the perimeter, but he, as the smallest, was seldom given any duty. Perhaps to another this would be liberating. To him, it had always been humiliating. As any problem to overcome is merely a set of smaller problems to overcome in a sequence, he divided his goal of becoming a dragon into three steps. First, he would find a way to have colorful scales like the dragon. Second, he would learn to speak the language of men like the dragon. Third, he would learn to fly like the dragon. Wit made the scene unfold in front of Kaladin. A colorful land with thick green grass that wasn't dead after all, it simply didn't move except in the wind. Creatures unlike any Kaladin had ever seen, furry and strange, exotic. The little dog walked into a wooden structure, a barn, though it hadn't been built with stone on the east side to withstand storms. It barely looked waterproof. How would they keep the grain from spoiling? Kaladin cocked his head at this oddity as the dog encountered a tall man in work clothing sorting through bags of seeds. The dog chose the scales first, Wit continued, accompanied by the quiet flute music, as it seemed the easiest, and he wanted to begin his transformation with an early victory. He knew the farmer owned many seeds in a variety of colors, and they were the shape of little scales. Because he was not a thief, the dog did not take these, but he asked the other animals where the farmer obtained new ones. It turns out the farmer could make seeds by putting them in the ground, waiting for plants to grow, then taking more seeds from the stalks. Knowing this, the dog borrowed some seeds and did the same, accompanying the farmer's eldest son on his daily work. As the youth worked, the dog moved alongside him, digging holes for seeds with his paws and planting them carefully with his mouth. It was an amusing scene, watching the dog work, not only because the animal did all this with feet and snout, but because the ground parted when the dog pawed at it. It wasn't made of stone, but something else.
This is in Shinovar, isn't it? Kaladin asked. Sigsel told me about ground like that.
Hush, Wit said. This isn't the part where you talk. The farmer's eldest son found the dog's actions quite amusing, then incredible as the dog went out each day gripping a watering can in his teeth. The little dog watered each seed just as the farmer did. He learned to weed and fertilize, and eventually the dog was rewarded with his own small crop of colorful seeds. After replacing what he'd borrowed from the farmer, the dog got himself wet and rolled in his seeds, sticking them all over his body. He then presented himself to the other dogs.
"Do you admire my wonderful new scales?" he asked his fellow animals. Do I not look like a dragon?
They, in turn, laughed at him.
Those are not scales, they said. You look stupid and silly. Go back to being a dog.
Kaladin put a spoonful of stew into his mouth, staring at the illusion. The way the colors worked was mesmerizing, though he had to admit the dog did look silly covered in seeds. The dog slunk away, feeling foolish and hurt. He had failed at his first task to have scales like a dragon. The dog, however, was not daunted. Surely if he could speak with the grand voice of a dragon, they would all see. And so the dog spent his free time watching the children of the farmer. There were three: the eldest son, who helped in the fields, the middle daughter, who helped with the animals, and the toddler, who was too young to help but was learning to speak. Whit made the family appear, working in the yard. The farmer's wife, who was taller than the farmer, a youth, lanky and deciduous, a daughter, who would someday share her mother's height, a baby who toddled around the yard, tended by them all as they did their chores.
This, Whit noted, is almost too easy.
Too easy? Kaladin asked, absently taking another bite of stew.
For years I've had to make do with hints of illusions, suggesting scenes, leaving most to the imagination. Now, having the power to do more, I find it less satisfying.
Anyway, the dog figured that the best way to learn the language of men was to study their youngest child. So the dog played with the baby, stayed with him, and listened as he began to form words. The dog played with the daughter, too, helped her with yard work. He soon found he could understand her if he tried hard. But he couldn't form words. He tried so hard to speak as they did, but his mouth could not make that kind of speech. His tongue did not work like a human tongue. Eventually, while watching the tall and serious daughter, he noticed she could make the words of humans on paper. The dog was overjoyed by this. It was a way to speak without having a human tongue. The dog joined her at the table where she studied, inspecting the letters as she made them. He failed many times, but eventually learned to scratch the letters in the dirt himself. The farmer and his family thought this an amazing trick. The dog was sure he had found a way to prove he was becoming a dragon. He returned to the other dogs in the field and showed them his writing ability by writing their names in the dirt. They, however, could not read the words. When the dog explained what writing was, they laughed.
"This is not the loud and majestic voice of a dragon," the dog said. "This is speaking so quietly nobody can hear it. You look silly and stupid. Go back to being a dog."
They left the dog to stare at his writing as rain began to fall, washing the words away. He realized they were correct. He had failed to speak with the proud and powerful voice of the dragon. The image of the dog in the rain felt far too familiar to Kaladin, far too personal.
But there was still hope, Whit said. If the dog could just fly, if he could achieve this feat, the dogs would have to acknowledge his transformation.
This task seemed even harder than the previous two. However, the dog had seen a curious device in the barn. The farmer would tie bales of hay with a rope, then raise or lower them using a pulley in the rafters. This was essentially flying, was it not?
The bales of hay soared in the air.
And so the dog practiced pulling on the rope himself and learned the mechanics of the device. He found that the pulley could be balanced with a weight on the other side, which made the bales of hay lower slowly and safely. The dog took his leash and tied it around him to make a harness, like the ones that wrapped up the hay. Then he tied a sack slightly lighter than he was to the rope, creating a weight to balance him. After using his mouth to tie the rope to his harness, he climbed to the top of the barn's loft and called for the other dogs to come in. When they arrived, he leaped gracefully off the loft. It worked! The dog lowered down slowly, striking a magnificent pose in the air.
He was flying! He soared like the dragon had. He felt the air around him and knew the sensation of being up high with everything below him. When he landed, he felt so proud and so free. Then the other dogs laughed, and the loudest they had ever laughed. "That is not flying like a dragon," they said. "You fell slowly. You looked so stupid and silly. Go back to being a dog." This, at long last, crushed the dog's hopes. He realized the truth. A dog like him simply could not become a dragon. He was too small, too quiet, too silly. Frankly, the sight of the dog being lowered on the rope had looked a bit silly. "They were right," Kaladin said. "That wasn't flying." Whit nodded. "Oh, is this the place where I talk?" Kaladin said. "If you wish." "I don't wish. Get on with the story." Whit grinned, then leaned forward, waving in the air and making the sounds of shouting coming from a distant part of the illusion, not yet visible. "What was that?" The dog looked up confused. He heard noises. Sudden shouting? Yells of panic? The dog raced out of the barn to find the farmer and his family huddled around the small farmyard well, which was barely wide enough for the bucket. The dog put his paws up on the edge of the well and looked down. Far below, in the deep darkness of the hole, he heard crying and splashing. Kaladin leaned forward, staring into the darkness. A pitiful gurgling cry was barely audible over the splashing. "The littlest child of the farmer and his wife had fallen into the well," Whit whispered, "and was drowning." The family screamed and wept. There was nothing to be done, or was there? In a flash, the dog knew what to do. He bit the bucket off the well's rope, then had the eldest son tie the rope to his harness. He wrote, "Lower me," in the dirt, then hopped up onto the rim of the well. Finally, he threw himself into the well as the farmer grabbed the crank. Lowered down on this rope, the dog flew into the darkness. He found the baby all the way underwater, but shoved his snout in and took hold of the baby's clothing with his teeth. A short time later, when the family pulled him back up, the dog appeared holding the littlest child, wet, crying, but very much alive. That night, the family set a place for the little dog at their table and gave him a sweater to keep him warm, his name written across the front with letters he could read. They served a feast with food the dog had helped grow. They gave him some of the cake, celebrating the birthday of the child whose life he had saved. That night, it rained on the other dogs who slept outside in the cold barn, which leaked. But the little dog snuggled into a warm bed beside the fire, hugged by the farmer's children, his belly full. And as he did, the dog sadly thought to himself, "I could not become a dragon. I am an utter and complete failure." The end. Whit clapped his hands, and the images vanished. He gave a seated bow. Design lowered her flute and flared out her pattern again as if to give her own bow. Then Whit picked up his bowl of stew and continued eating. "Wait," Kaladin said, standing. "That's it?"
"Did you miss the end at the end?" Design said. "It indicates that is the end."
"What kind of ending is that?" Kaladin said. "The dog decides he's a failure?"
"Endings are an art," Whit said loftily. "A precise and unquestionable art, Bridge Man. Yes, that is the ending."
"Why did you tell me this?" Kaladin demanded.
"You asked for a story."
"I wanted a useful story," he said, waving his hand. "Like the story of the Emperor on the island or of Fleet who kept running."
"You didn't specify that," Whit said. "You said you wanted a story. I provided one. That is all."
"That's the wrong ending," Kaladin said. "That dog was incredible. He learned to write. How many animals can write on any world?"
"Not many, I should say," Whit noted.
"He learned to farm and to use tools," Kaladin said. He saved a child's life. That dog is a storming hero.
The story wasn't about him trying to be a hero, Wit said. It was about him trying to be a dragon, in which, pointedly, he failed.
I told you, Design said happily, dogs can't be dragons.
Who cares? Kaladin said, stalking back and forth. By looking up at the dragon and by trying to become better, he outgrew the other dogs. He achieved something truly special.
Kaladin stopped, then narrowed his eyes at Wit, feeling his anger turn to annoyance.
This story is about me, isn't it? I said I'm not good enough. You think I have impossible goals, and I'm intentionally ignoring the things I've accomplished.
Wit pointed with his spoon.
I told you this story has no meaning. You promised not to assign it one.
As a matter of fact, Design said, you didn't give him a chance to promise. You simply kept talking.
Wit glared at her.
Blah, 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 blah,
she said, rocking her pattern head back and forth at each word.
Your stories always have a point, Kaladin said. I am an artist, Wit said. I should thank you not to demean me by insisting my art must be trying to accomplish something. In fact, you shouldn't enjoy art. You should simply admit that it exists, then move on. Anything else is patronizing.
Kaladin folded his arms, then sat. Wit, playing games again. Couldn't he ever be clear? Couldn't he ever say what he meant?
Any meaning, Wit said softly, is for you to assign, Kaladin. I merely tell the stories. Have you finished your stew?
Kaladin realized he had. He'd eaten the entire bowl while listening.
I can't keep this bubble up much longer, I'm afraid, Wit said. He'll notice if I do, and then he'll destroy me. I have violated our agreement, which exposes me to his direct action. I'd rather not be killed, as I have 7 more people I wanted to insult today.
Kaladin nodded, standing up again. He realized that somehow the story fired him up. He felt stronger, less for the words and more for how annoyed he'd grown at Wit. A little light, a little warmth, a little fire, and he felt ready to walk out into the winds again. Yet he knew the darkness would return. It always did.
Can you tell me the real ending? Kaladin asked, his voice small. Before I go back out.
Wit stood and stepped over, then put his hand on Kaladin's back and leaned in.
That night, he said, the little dog snuggled into a warm bed beside the fire, hugged by the farmer's children, his belly full. And as he did, the dog thought to himself, I doubt any dragon ever had it so good anyway.
He smiled and met Kaladin's eyes.
It won't be like that for me, Kaladin said. You told me it would get worse.
It will, Wit said. But then it will get better.
Then it will get worse again.
Then better. This is life. And I will not lie by saying that every day will be sunshine. But there will be sunshine again. And that is a very different thing to say. That is truth. I promise you, Kaladin. You will be warm again.
Kaladin nodded in thanks, then turned to the hateful winds. He felt a push against his back as Wit sent him forward. Then the light vanished, along with all it contained.
81. Trapped. 7 years ago. Eshonai tipped her head back, feeling water stream off her carapace skull plate. Returning to war form after so long in work form felt like revisiting a familiar clearing, hidden in the trees, rarely encountered but always waiting for her. She did like this form. She would not see it as a prison. She met Thud and Relaine as they emerged from hollows in the stone, where they too had returned to this form. Many of her friends had never left it. War form was convenient for many reasons, though Eshonai didn't like it quite as well as work form. There was something about the aggression this form provoked in her. She worried she would seek excuses to fight. Thud stretched, humming to joy. "Feels good," he said. "I feel alive in this form." "Too alive," Relaine said. "Do the rhythms sound louder to you?" "Not to me," Thud said. Eshenai shook her head. She didn't hear the rhythms any differently. Indeed, she'd been wondering if, upon adopting this form again, she'd hear the pure tone of Roshar as she did the first time. She hadn't. "Shall we?" she asked, gesturing toward the spreading plateaus. Relaine started toward one of the bridges, but Thud sang loudly to amusement and charged the nearby chasm, leaping and soaring over it with an incredible bound. Eshenai dashed after him to do the same. Each form brought with it a certain level of instinctual understanding. When she reached the edge, her body knew what to do. She sprang in a powerful leap, the air whistling through the grooves in her carapace and flapping the loose robe she'd worn into the storm. She landed with a solid crunch, her feet grinding stone as she slid to a stop. The rhythm of confidence thrummed in her ears, and she found herself grinning. She had missed that. Relaine landed next to her, a hulking figure with black and red skin patterns forming an intricate marbling. He hummed to confidence as well. "Come on," Thud shouted from nearby. He leaped another chasm. Attuning joy, Eshenai ran after him. Together the three of them chased and dashed, climbed and soared, spanning chasms, climbing up and over rock formations, sprinting across plateaus. The shattered plains felt like a playground. "This must be what islands and oceans are like," she thought, as she surveyed the plains from up high. She'd heard about them in songs, and she'd always imagined an ocean as a huge network of streams moving between sections of land. But no, she'd seen Gavilar's map. In that painting, the bodies of water had seemed as wide as countries. Water, with nothing to see but more water. She attuned anxiety and awe, complementary emotions in her experience. She dropped from the rock formation and landed on the plateau, then bounded after Thud. How far would she have to travel to find those oceans? Judging by the map, only a few weeks to the east. Once, such a distance would have been daunting, but now she'd made the trek all the way to Kolinar and back. The trip to the Alethi capital had been one of the sweetest and most exhilarating experiences of her life. So many new places, so many wonderful people, so many strange plants, strange sights, strange foods to taste. When they'd fled, the same wonders had become threats overnight. The entire trip home had been a blur of marching, sleeping, and foraging in human fields. Eshenai reached another chasm and leaped, trying to recapture her excitement. She increased her pace, coming up even with Thud and eventually passing him, before the two of them pulled to a halt to wait for Relaine, who had slowed a few plateaus back. He had always been a careful one, and he seemed better able to control the inclinations of the new form. Her heart racing, Eshenai reached out of habit to wipe her brow, but this form didn't have sweat on her forehead to drip into her eyes. Instead, the carapace armor trapped air from her forward motion, then pushed it up underneath to cool her skin. The awesome energy of the form meant she could probably have kept running for hours before feeling any real strain, perhaps longer. Indeed, the warforms during their flight from Alethkar had carried food for the others and still moved faster than the work forms. At the same time, Eshenai was getting hungry. She remembered well how much food this form required at each meal. Thud leaned against a high rock formation as they waited, watching some windspren play in the air. Eshernai wished she'd brought her book for drawing maps of the plains. She'd found it in the human market of Kolinar. Such a small, simple thing. It had been expensive by Alethi standards, but oh so cheap by her standards. An entire book of papers? All for a few little bits of emerald? She'd seen steel weapons there, too, sitting in the market. For sale! The listeners protected, polished, and revered each weapon they'd found on the plains, keeping them for generations, passed down from parent to child. The humans had entire stalls of them.
"This is going to go poorly for us, isn't it?" Thud asked.
Eshernai realized she'd been humming to the lost. She stopped, but met his eyes and knew that he knew. Together they walked around the stone formation and looked westward, toward the cities that had for centuries been listener homes. Dark smoke filled the air, the Alethi burning wood as they set up enormous cook fires and settled into their camps. They'd arrived in force, tens of thousands of them, swarms of soldiers with dozens of shard bearers, come to exterminate her people.
"Maybe not," Eshernai said. "In war form, we're stronger than they are. They have equipment and skill, but we have strength and endurance. If we have to fight them, this terrain will heavily favor us."
"Did you really have to do it, though?"
Thud asked, pleading.
"Did you need to have him killed?"
She'd answered this before, but she didn't avoid the responsibility. She had voted for Gavilar to die, and she'd been the reason for the vote in the first place. "He was going to bring them back, Thud," Eshernai said to reprimand. "Our ancient gods. I heard him say it. He thought I'd be happy to hear of it."
"So you killed him?"
Thud asked, to agony.
"Now they'll kill us, Eshernai. How is this any better?"
She attuned tension. Thud in turn attuned reconciliation. He seemed to recognize that bringing this up again and again was accomplishing nothing.
"It is done," Eshernai said. "So now, we need to hold out. We might not even have to fight them. We can harvest gemstones from the great shells and speed crop growth. The humans can't leap these chasms, and so they'll have trouble ever getting to us.
We'll be safe." "We'll be trapped," Thud said, "in the center of these plains, for months, perhaps years. You're fine with that, Eshernai?"
Relaine finally caught up to them, jogging over and humming to amusement. Perhaps he thought the two of them silly for speeding ahead. Eshernai looked away from Thud and stared out across the plains, not toward the humans, but toward the ocean, the origin, places she could have gone, places she'd planned to go. Thud knew her too well. He understood how much it hurt to be trapped here.
"They will strike inward," she thought. "The humans won't come all this way to turn around because of a few chasms. They have resources we can only imagine, and there are so many of them. They'll find a way to get to us."
Escaping out the other side of the plains wasn't an option either. If the chasm fiends there didn't get them, the humans eventually would. To flee would be to abandon the natural fortification of the plains.
"I'll do what I have to do, Thud," Eshernai said to determination. "I'll do what is right, whatever the cost, to us, to me."
"They have fought wars," Thud said. "They have generals. Great military thinkers. We've had war form for only a year."
"We'll learn," Eshernai said, "and create our own generals. Our ancestors paid with their very minds to bring us freedom. If the humans find a way to come for us in here, we will fight until we persuade the humans that the cost is too high
until they realize we won't go meekly to slavery, like the poor beings they use as servants. Until they learn they cannot have us, our blades, or our souls. We are a free people. Forever. Venli gathered her friends around, humming softly to Craving as she revealed the gemstones in her hands. Voidspren. 5 of them, trapped as Ulim had been when first brought to her. Inside her gem heart, he hummed words of encouragement. Ever since the events at the human city, he'd treated her with far more respect, and he'd never again abandoned her. The longer he remained, the better she could hear the new rhythms, the rhythms of power. She had claimed this section of Narak, the city at the center of the plains, for her scholars. Friends who she and Ulim had determined, after careful discussion, shared her hunger for a better world. Trustworthy enough, she hoped. Once they had Voidspren in their gem hearts, she'd be far more confident in their discretion.
What are they?
Demid asked, his hand resting on Venli's shoulder. He'd been the first and most eager to listen. He didn't know everything, naturally, but she was glad to have him. She felt stronger when he was around, braver than Eshonai. After all, could Eshonai have ever taken this step? These hold Spren, Venli explained. When you accept one into your gem heart, they'll hold your current Spren with them, keeping you in your current form, but you'll have a secret companion to help you, guide you. Together we're going to solve the greatest challenge our people have ever known. Which is? Tusa asked to skepticism. Our world is connected to another, Venli explained, handing one gemstone to each of her friends. A place called Shadesmar. Hundreds of Spren exist there, who can grant us the ability to harness the power of the storms. They've traveled a long way, as part of a great storm. They've gone as far as they can on their own, however. Getting gemstones like these to our side takes enormous effort, and is impossible on a large scale. So we need another way to bring those Spren across. We're going to figure it out, then we're going to persuade the rest of the listeners to join with us in adopting forms of power. We'll be smart. We won't be ruled by the Spren this time around. We'll rule them. Eshonai and the others have foolishly thrown everyone into an unwanted war. So we have to take this step. We will be remembered as the ones who saved our people. 82. Knife.
Oh, father, 7,000 years.
How could you not tell me this? Radiant demanded, as she knelt and shouted at the cube on the floor. Rastaris is not only the Honor Spren's High Judge, he's one of the Storming Heralds.
You didn't require the information at that time, Moraes's voice said. Be Vale. She will understand.
Vale is even more angry at you, Moraes, Radiant said, standing up. You sent us into a dangerous situation without proper preparation. Withholding this information wasted weeks while the three of us searched the fortress like an idiot.
We didn't want you asking after a herald, Moraes said, his voice frustratingly calm. That might have alerted him. So far as we're aware, he hasn't figured out that we know his true identity. Gavilar may have known, but no others in the Sons of Honor had an inkling that they served one of the very beings they were seeking, in their naive ignorance, to restore to Roshar. The irony is quite poetic. Pattern said from beside the door, where he was watching for Adolin. What? Radiant asked him. You like irony now, too?
Irony tastes good. Like sausage.
And have you ever tasted sausage?
I don't believe I have a sense of taste, Pattern said. So, Irony tastes like what I imagine sausage would taste like when I'm imagining tastes.
Radiant rubbed her forehead, looking back at the cube. So unfair. She was accustomed to being able to stare down her troops, but one could not properly glare at a man who talked to you out of a box. You told us we'd know what to do when we found Rastari's, Radiant told Moraes. Well, we are here now and we have no idea how to proceed. What did you do the moment you found out? Moraes said. Cursed your name. Then? Contacted you directly to curse at you some more. Which was the correct choice. See? You knew exactly what to do. Radiant folded her arms, warm with anger, frustration, and, admittedly, embarrassment. She bled into being Vale, and the anger returned. The time has come, she said, for us to deal, Moraes. Deal? The deal has already been set. You do as I have requested, and you will receive the offered reward, in addition to the practice and training you are receiving under my hand. That is interesting, Vale said, because I see this differently. I have come all this way through great hardship. Because of Adolin's sacrifice, I've gained access to one of the most remote fortresses on Roshar. I have succeeded where you explicitly told me your other agents have failed. Now that I'm here, instead of receiving training or practice, as you say, I find that you've been withholding vital information from me. From my perspective, there is no incentive to continue this arrangement, as the promised reward is of little interest to me. Even Shallan is questioning its value. Your refusal to give me important information makes me question what else you held back. Now I'm questioning if what I'm to do here is possibly against my interests and the interests of those I love. So, let me ask plainly, why am I really here? Why are you so interested in Kalek? And why, explicitly, should I continue on this path? Moraes did not respond immediately. Hello, Vale, he finally said. I'm glad you came out to speak with me. Answer my questions, Moraes. First, it is time to open the cube, Moraes said. Vale frowned. The communication cube? I thought you said that would ruin the thing. If you break into it, you will ruin it. Pick it up. Heft it. Listen for the side where my voice is weakest as I hum. She knelt beside the cube again and picked it up, listening to Moraes' humming voice. Yes, the sound was weaker from one direction. I found it, she said. Good, Moraes said. Put your hand on that plane of the cube and twist it to the right. She felt it click as she touched it. She suspected Moraes had done something to unlock the device from wherever he was. When she twisted that plane of the cube, it turned easily and came off, revealing a small compartment that contained an intricate metal dagger with a gemstone on the end of the grip. So you do want me to kill him, she said. One cannot kill a herald, Moraes said. They are immortal. Do not think of Kalek as a person. He is an ageless, eternal spren, formed of honor's substance and will. He is as gravity or light, force, not man. And you want me to stab that force with this knife, Vale said, undoing the straps and prying it out from the cube. The cavity was only a small part of the hollow portion in the cube, and a layer of steel sectioned off the rest. Moraes' voice came from the sealed portion. How had he weighted the cube, such that she didn't feel one end was heavier than the others? I want you, he said, to collect the soul of Kalek also known as Restaris. The knife will trap his essence in that gemstone. That seems overly cruel, Vale said, looking over the knife. Cruel like the span reeds you so eagerly use, despite the spren trapped inside? It is no different. The being called Kalek is a receptacle of incredible knowledge. Gemstone imprisonment will not hurt him, and we will be able to communicate with him. We have two other heralds in the tower, Vale said. I could ask them anything you want to know. You think they'd answer? How useful have they been, talking to Jasnah? Talon Elat is completely insane, and Shalash is deceptively reticent. They talk of their oath pact, yes, and fighting the fused, but rarely reveal anything practical. This isn't very persuasive, Vale said. Yes, I know what you want me to do, but I suspected it from the beginning. If you want me to do this, I need to know why. What specifically do you expect to learn from him? Our master, Thydikar, has an affliction similar to that of the heralds. He needs access to a herald to learn more about his state, so he might save himself from the worst of its effects. That's not good enough, Vale said. Radiant and Shallan won't let me do your dirty work for such a petty reason. She put the dagger back in the cube. I came here to report on Restaris' location. Shallan specifically told you we wouldn't kill him. And yes, I count stabbing him with this device as the same thing. Little knife, Moraes said, his voice growing softer. Why did Sadeus need to die? She hesitated, her hand still on the dagger, which she was trying to reattach to the straps in the cube. This being, Mraes continued, that they call Kalek, is a monster. He, along with the other eight, abandoned their oath pact and stranded Talon Elat, the bearer of agonies, alone in damnation, to withstand torture for thousands of years. The enemy has returned, but have the heralds come to help? No. At best, they hide. At worst, their madness leads them to hasten the world's destruction. Kalek has become indecisive to the point of madness, and like most of them, he is afraid. He wants to escape his duties. He worked with Gavilar, knowing full well that doing so would cause the return of the fused and the end of our peace, because he hoped to find a way to escape this world, a way to abandon us, as he had already abandoned his oaths and his friends. He possesses knowledge essential to our fight against the invaders. However, he will not share it willingly. He hides himself away in the world's most remote fortress and tries to pretend there is no war, that he is not culpable. He is. The only way to make him do his duty is to bring him back by force. And the best and easiest way to do that is to trap his soul. Storms. That was a longer speech than she usually got out of Moraes. There was passion, conviction in his voice. Vale almost felt persuaded. I can't move against him, she said. He is set to judge Adolin in this trial. If Kalek vanished, that would throw all kinds of suspicion on us, and Adolin would most certainly be imprisoned. I can't risk it. Moraes said. If only there were a way that someone, having locked away Kalek's soul, could take his place, wear his face, pass judgment, vindicating your husband and commanding the honor spren to join the war again. If only we had sent a person capable of single-handedly turning the tide of this war, through the use of a targeted illusion. In that moment, Vale lost control to Shallan, because what Moraes said here, it made too much sense. Oh, storms, Shallan thought, growing cold. Stormfather above and Night Watcher below, he's right. That is a solution to this problem. A way to let Adolin win. A way to bring the Honor Spren back. So this was how he manipulated her this time. She wanted to buck him for that reason alone. If only what he said weren't so logical. It would be easy to replace Kalek, assuming she could get some stormlight. No, Vale warned. It's not that easy. We'd have a difficult time impersonating a herald. We'd do the replacement at the last moment, Shallan thought. On the final day of the trial. To reduce the amount of time we need to pretend, and to give us a few days to scout out his personality. Killing Sadeus saved thousands of lives, Moraes continued in his soft, oily voice. Delivering Kalek to us, sending the Honor Spren to bond Windrunners, could save millions. Vale isn't certain we could imitate a herald, Shallan said. The herald is erratic, Moraes said. All of them are now. With a few pointers, you could escape notice. Honor Spren are not good at noticing subterfuge, or at distinguishing what is odd behavior for humans, or those who were once human. You can accomplish this. And after the trial, Kalek could insist he has to visit Urithiru himself, leaving the Spren completely ignorant of what you've done. It would be wrong, Moraes. It feels wrong. Earlier, Vale demanded a deal. Though I normally reject this sort of talk, I find it encouraging that she did not demand money or power. She wanted information, to know why she was doing what she did. You three are worthy hunters. So I will revise the deal as requested. Perform as I ask here, and I will release you from your apprenticeship. You will become a full member of our organization. You will not only have access to the knowledge you seek, but also have a say in what we are doing. Our grand plans. Inside, Vale perked up at this, but Shallan was surprised by how much she responded to that offer. A full ghost blood? That was the way to strike at a herald, she said. It sounds wrong, Moraes, very wrong. You are weak, he said. You know it. She bowed her head. But part of you is not, he continued, a part that can be that strong. Let that side of you do what needs to be done. Save your husband, your kingdom, and your world all at once. Become that hunter, Shallan. Become the knife.
The Honor Spren surrounding the High Judge made room for Adolin as he approached, Blended following behind. He didn't miss the glares that many of them gave her. No, there was no love lost between the two varieties of Spren. He should probably feel reverence for the High Judge. This was Kalek, though the Spren called him Kalak for some reason. Either way, he was one of the heralds, so Blended had explained. Many people back home thought of him as the Stormfather, and though that had never been true, he was one of the most ancient beings in all of creation, a god to many, an immortal soldier for justice and honor. He was also short, with thinning hair. He felt like the type of man you'd find administering some minor city in the backwater of Alethkar. And if he was anything like Ash or Taln, the two heralds who now resided at Urithiru, well, His acquaintance with those two caused Adolin to lower his expectations in this particular case. Kallek spoke with several Honor Spren leaders as they strolled up the lower portion of the western plain, entering a stone pathway made up of a multitude of colored cobblestones vaguely in the pattern of a gust of wind. The group paused as they saw Adolin ahead. He removed his hand from his sword out of respect, then bowed to the herald.
A human? Kallek said. Why is he here? He looks dangerous, Sekir.
He is, said the Honor Spren beside Kallek.
Sekir was a leader of the fortress and appeared as an ancient Honor Spren with a long blue-white beard.
This is Adolin Colin, son of Dalinar Colin.
The bondsmith, Kallek said, and shied away from Adolin. Good heavens, why have you let him in here?
I have come, Great One, Adolin said, to petition the Honor Spren for their aid in our current battle.
Your current battle? Against Odium? Kallek laughed. Boy, you're doomed. You realize that, right? Tanavast is dead. Like, completely dead. The Oath Pact is broken somehow. The only thing left is to try to get off the ship before it sinks.
Holy Lord, Sekir said. We let this one in because he offered to stand trial in the stead of the humans for the pain they have caused our people.
You're going to try him for the recreants?
Kallek asked, looking around uncertainly at the others near him.
Isn't that a bit extreme?
He offered, Holy Lord.
Not a smart one, is he?
Kallek looked to Adolin, who hesitantly pulled up from his bow.
You've gotten yourself in deep, boy. They take this kind of thing very seriously around here.
I hope to show them, Great One, that we are not their enemies, that the best course forward is for them to join us in our fight. It is, one might say, the honorable choice.
Honor is dead, Kallek snapped. Aren't you paying attention? This world belongs to Odium now. He has his own storm, for heaven's sake.
Blended nudged Adolin. Right. He was so distracted by Kallek that he'd forgotten the purpose of meeting with him.
Great One, Adolin said. I've decided to petition for a trial by witness. Would you be willing to grant me this?
Trial by witness, Kallek said. Well, that would make this mess end faster. What do you think, Sekir?
I don't think this would be a wise...
Hold on, I don't care what you think, Kallek said. Here I am, years after joining you, and you still don't have a way for me to get off this cursed world. Fine, boy, trial by witness it is. We can start, the day after tomorrow. Is that acceptable for everyone?
No one objected.
Great, Kallek said. Day after tomorrow. Okay, then. Let's have it at the forum, shall we? I guess everyone will want a watch, and that has the most seats.
Object to this, Blended whispered to Adolin. Do not let it be. You don't want to have to persuade the audience as well as the judge.
Great One, Adolin said. I had hoped this to be an intimate, personal discussion of...
Tough, Kallek said. You should have thought of that before coming in here to create a storm. Everyone knows how this trial will end, so we might as well make a good time of it for them.
Adolin felt a sinking sensation as Kallek led the group of Honor Spren around him. Though few light-eyed judges were ever truly impartial, there was an expectation that they'd try to act with honor before the eyes of the Almighty. But this herald basically told him the trial would be a sham. The man had made his judgment before hearing any arguments.
How on Roshar was that ever considered a deity? Adolin thought in a daze. The heralds had fallen so far. Either that, or perhaps these 10 people had always been only that. People. After all, crowning a man a king or high prince didn't necessarily make him anything grander than he'd been. Adolin knew that firsthand.
That could have gone better, Blended said. But at least a trial by witness is. Come. I have one day, it seems, to prepare you to be thrown into the Angerspren's den.
83. The Games of Men and Singers.
I remember so few of those centuries. I am a blur, a smear on the page, a gaunt stretch of ink made all the more insubstantial with each passing day.
Venli knelt on the floor of a secluded hallway on the 15th floor of Urethiru. The stones whispered to her that the place had once been called Ur. The word meant original in the dawn chant, an ancient place with ancient stones. There was a Spren that lived here, not dead, as Raboniel had once proclaimed. This Spren was the veins of the tower, its inner metal and crystal running through walls, ceilings, floors. The stones had not been created by that Spren, though a grand project had reshaped them, reshaped Ur, the original mountain that had been here before. The stones remembered being that mountain. They remembered so many things, which they expressed to Venli, not with words, rather as impressions, like those a hand left in creme before it dried, or the impression Venli's hands left in the floor as they sank into the eager stone. Remember, the stones whispered, remember what you have forgotten. She remembered sitting at her mother's feet as a child, listening to the songs. The music had flowed like water, etching patterns in her brain, memories, like the passage of time etched canals in stone. Listeners were not like humans, who grew slow as trees. Listeners grew like vines, quick and eager. By age 3, she'd been singing with her mother. By age 10, she'd been considered an adult. Venli remembered those years, looking up to Eshonai, who seemed so big, although just a year older than Venli. She had vague memories of holding her father's finger as he sang with her mother. She remembered love, family, grandparents, cousins. How had she forgotten? As a child, ambition and love had been like two sides of her face, each with its own vibrant pattern. To the sound of Odium's rhythms, one side had shone, while the other withered. She had become a person who wanted only to achieve her goals, not because those goals would help others, but because of the goals themselves. It was in that moment that Venli saw for herself the depth of his lies. He claimed to be of all passions, and yet where was the love she'd once felt? The love for her mother, her sister, her friends. For a while she'd even forgotten her love for Demid, though it had helped to awaken her. It felt wrong to be using his light to practice her surge binding, but the stones whispered that it was well. Odium and his tone had become part of Roshar, as cultivation and honor, who had not been created alongside the planet, had become part of it. His power was natural, and no more wrong or right than any other part of nature. Venli searched for something else, the tone of cultivation. Odium's song could suffuse her, fueling her powers and inflaming her emotions, but that tone had belonged to her people long before he'd arrived. While she searched for it, she listened to her mother's songs in her mind, like chains spiked into the stone so they'd remain strong during storms. They reached backward through time, through generations, to her people, leaving the battlefield, walking away rather than continuing to squabble over the same ground over and over. They hadn't merely rejected the singer gods. They'd rejected the conflict. Holding to family, singing to love despite their dull forms, they'd left the war and gone a new way. The tones snapped into her mind, cultivation and odium mixing into a harmony, and it thrummed through Venli. She opened her eyes as power spread from her through the stones. They began to shake and vibrate to the sound of her rhythm, liquid, forming peaks and valleys in time with the music. The floor, ceiling, and walls before her rippled, and a trail of people formed from the stone, moving, alive again, as they strode away from pain and war and killing. Freedom. The stones whispered to her of freedom. Rock seemed so stable, so unchangeable. But if you saw it on the time scale of Spren, it was always changing, deliberately, over centuries. She had never known her ancestors, but she knew their songs. She could sing those and imitate their courage, their love, their wisdom. The power slipped from her, as it always did. The tone faded, and her control over the stone ended. She needed more practice and more light. Still, she didn't need Timber's encouraging thrum to keep her spirits high as she stood. For she had in front of her, in miniature, a sculpture of her ancestors striking out toward the unknown. More, she had their songs. Because of her mother's diligent and insistent teaching, the songs had not died with the listeners. An hour later, Venli walked the hallways much lower in the tower, waiting for Leshwi. She met with the Heavenly One almost every day. Raboniel knew the meetings were happening, of course, and Leshwi knew that Raboniel knew. Still, Venli and Leshwi met in secret. It was all part of the dance of politics between the fused. They met as if by happenstance. Leshwi hovered solemnly through a corridor at the right time, her long black train rustling against the stone. Venli fell into step beside her mistress. "The pursuer has found the Windrunner's parents, Ancient One," Venli said. "I'm certain of it. He posted 2 Nightform Regals at the Radiant Infirmary."
"Which ones?"
"Urialin and Nistar."
"Light and mystery," Leshwi said, translating their names from the ancient language.
Like many of the Regals, they had taken new names for themselves upon their awakening.
"Yes, this is a signal, but the pursuer is not that subtle. If you look, I suspect that Raboniel is the one who suggested those 2.
"What do we do?" Venli said to anxiety.
"Nothing, for now. My authority extends far enough to protect them. This is merely a warning."
"Raboniel threatens to let the pursuer have the humans," Venli said. "That is why she posted those 2 guards, to lord her advantage over us."
"Perhaps," Leshwi said, floating with her hands behind her back. "Perhaps not. Raboniel does not think like other fused, Venli. She hears a much grander song. A skewed and twisted one, but one she seeks to sing without traditional regard for Odium's plans or those of honor, now dead."
"She makes her own side, then," Venli said. "She seeks to play both armies against one another and profit herself."
"Do not transpose your mortal ambitions upon Raboniel," Leshwi said to ridicule. "You think too small, Venli, to understand her. I think too small to understand her. Regardless, you did well in bringing this to me. Watch for other signs like this."
They reached the atrium, the hallway they'd been following merging with it like a river flowing into a sea. Here, Heavenly Ones soared up and down, delivering supplies to the scouts and masked ones on the upper floors. Those continued to keep watch for Windrunners. The charade was wearing thin at this point. Raboniel was certain Dalinar Kholin had seen through it and knew something very wrong was happening at the tower. The supplies to the upper floors could have been delivered via the lifts. However, Raboniel had put the Heavenly Ones to work, making it very clear that she had both the authority and the inclination to keep them busy. This had driven off many of them, who preferred their sanctuaries in Kolinar. Perhaps that had been the point. Leshwe instead did as she was asked. She floated up and over the railing, her long train slipping over and then falling to drift in the open air beneath her. Another Heavenly One soared upward past them, trailing cloth of gold and red. "Ancient One," Venli said to Craving, stepping up to the railing. "What are we watching Raboniel for, if not to understand how she's trying to gain advantage over us? What is the purpose of my spying?" "We watch," Leshwe said, floating down to eye level with Venli. "Because we are frightened. To Raboniel, the games of men and singers are petty things, but so are their lives. We watch her, Venli, because we want a world to remain when she is finished with her plots." Venli felt a chill, attuning the terrors. As Leshwe flew off, Venli took a lift, haunted by those words. "The games of men and singers are petty things, but so are their lives." The ominous words pulled Venli down from her earlier optimism. After stepping off the lift, she decided to stop and check on Relaine and the others. She couldn't help attuning agony at the idea of those regals in the infirmary. At least the surgeon and his wife had the good sense to mostly stay out of sight. Venli slipped into the draped-off section of the room where Hesina was keeping watch today. She nodded as Venli entered, then grimaced and glanced toward the others inside. There was a new human here, one Venli didn't recognize, who stood with his eyes down, not speaking. Attention in the room was coming entirely from Liren and Relaine, who faced off at the rear, Relaine humming softly to betrayal. "What on Roshar?"
"I can't believe I'm hearing this," Relaine said. "I can't believe it. He's your son."
"My son is long dead, Bridgman," Liren said, quickly packing a small bag full of surgical implements. "Kaladin kept trying to explain this, and I only recently started understanding. He doesn't want to be my son anymore. If that's the case, it's difficult for me to see him as anything other than a killer and an agitator. Someone who recklessly endangered not just my family, but the lives of every human in the tower, while pursuing a vengeful grudge."
"So you're going to let him die?" Relaine demanded.
"I didn't say that," Liren snapped. "Do not put words in my mouth. I'll go as I would for anyone wounded."
"And afterward?" he demanded. "You said..."
"I said we'd see," Liren said. "It's possible I'll need to bring him down here to give him long-term care."
"You would give him up for execution?"
"If that's what is required, then so be it. I'll do my job as a surgeon, then let Kaladin deal with the consequences of his actions. I'm finished being a pawn in games of death. For either side." Relaine threw up his hands.
"What is the point of trying to save him if you're intending to have him killed?"
"Quiet," Venli hissed, glancing out the flimsy drapes toward the others in the room outside.
"What is going on here?"
Liren glared at Relaine, who again hummed to betrayal.
"Our son survived the events of the other day," Hesina said to Venli. "This is one of his friends. He says Kaladin's powers aren't working properly and his wounds aren't healing. He's in a coma and is slowly dying of what sounds like internal bleeding."
"That or an infection," Liren said, stuffing a few more things into his bag. "Can't tell from the description."
"We're not taking you to him," Relaine said, "unless you promise not to give him and Teft up to the enemy."
He looked to the other man in the room, the newcomer, who nodded in agreement.
Then he'll die for certain, Liren snapped. Blood on your hands.
The two glared at each other, and Venli attuned irritation, as if she didn't have enough to worry about. I'll go, Hesina said, walking over and taking the surgery bag off the table.
Hesina,
he's my son too, she said. Let's be on with this, Relaine. I can show you how to treat the fever and give him some anti-inflammatories, along with something to fight the infection.
And if it is internal bleeding? Liren asked. He will need surgery. You can't perform an operation like that in the field, Hesina.
He sounded angry, but those were fear spren at his feet, not anger spren. The surgeon turned away and pretended to arrange his instruments. But humans were so full of emotion, it spilled out of them. He couldn't hide what he was feeling from Venli. Frustration, worry. He could say what he wanted, but he loved his son.
He needs to be brought here, Liren said, his voice laden with pain as plain as any rhythm. I will go with you to help him. Then I want you to listen to my suggestion. If he's in a coma, he will need long-term care. We can put him in this room and pretend he's unconscious like the others. It's the best way.
He'd rather die, the newcomer whispered.
There was something odd about his voice that Venli couldn't place. He slurred his words. The chamber fell silent, save for one thing. Timber vibrated with excitement inside Venli. The little spren was at it so loudly, Venli was certain the others would hear. How could they not?
It was going to catch up to Cal eventually, Liren said, his tone morose. Most soldiers don't die on the battlefield, you know. Far more die from wounds, days later. My son taught you about triage, didn't he? What did he say about people with wounds like his?
The two former bridgemen glanced at each other.
Make them comfortable,
the human with the slurred words said.
Give them drink, pain medication, if you can spare it, so they are peaceful when they die.
Again, the room grew quiet, all save for Timber, practically bursting with sound. It's time, it's time, it's time! When Venli spoke, she almost believed it was Timber saying the words, and not her. What if, she said, I knew about an edge dancer whose powers still seem to work? One who I think we can rescue? It didn't take much time to explain the plan. Venli had been thinking about this for days now. She'd only needed some practice with her powers and a little help from Relaine. The edge dancer was kept in the same cell Relaine had occupied not long ago. Venli could get through that wall with ease. She was in control of her powers enough for that. The real trick would be pulling off the rescue without revealing or implicating herself. Timber pulsed in annoyance as Venli and Relaine hurried toward the cell. The human, Dabid, was taking another route. Venli didn't want to be seen walking with him.
How did you get a shard blade?
Relaine asked softly, to curiosity.
And how do they not know you have one?
It's a long story, Venli said, mostly because she hadn't thought of a proper lie yet.
It's Eshonai's, isn't it? Do you know what happened to her? I know you said she's dead. But how?
She died controlled by a void spren, Venli thought, because I tricked her into inviting one into her gem heart. She fell into a chasm after fighting a human shard bearer, then drowned, alone. I found her corpse, and, under the direction of a void spren, desecrated it by stealing her shards, but I don't have them.
There was a lot she could say.
No, I got it from a dead human. I bonded it while traveling to Kolinar, before the Fused found me and the others.
That was when they...
Relaine attuned the rhythm of the lost.
Yes,
Venli said to the same rhythm. When they took the rest of our friends. They left me because Odium wanted me to travel around, telling lies about our people to inspire the newly awakened singers.
I'm sorry, Relaine said. That must have been difficult for you, Venli.
I survived, Venli said. But if we're going to save this Radiant, we need to be certain the Fused can't trace this break-in to us. You can't intervene, Relaine. The human has to manage the distraction himself. Relaine hummed to consideration. What? Venli asked.
Dabit isn't the person I'd put in charge of something like this, he said. Until today I thought he was completely mute.
Is he trustworthy?
Absolutely, Relaine said. He's Bridge 4. But, well, I'd like to know why he spent so long without talking. The bridge runs hit him hard, I know, but there's something else.
He hummed to determination.
I won't intervene unless something goes wrong.
If you do, we all have to go into hiding, Venli said to skepticism. So make sure before you do anything. He nodded, still humming to determination, and they split up at the next intersection. Venli found her way to a particular quiet section of hallway, lit only by her held sphere. Most humans stayed away from this area. The pursuers' troops were housed nearby. Raboniel's occasional orders for peace to be maintained in the tower were barely enough to restrain those soldiers. She attuned peace, sometimes used by listeners for measuring time. Beyond this wall was the cell. As the fourth movement of the rhythm approached, Venli pressed her hand against the stone and drew in void light, requisitioned just earlier to replace what she'd used. Storms. She hoped news of her taking so much didn't reach Raboniel. Timber pulsed reassuringly. This stone, like the one earlier today, responded to Venli's touch. It shivered and rippled, as if it were getting a good back scratching. The stone whispered to her, "Move to the side." It guided her to the correct spot to breach the cell. Timber's rhythms pulsed through the rock, making it vibrate with the rhythm of hope. The fourth movement of peace arrived, the moment when Relaine would signal Dabid to go into the guards, bringing food for their lunch. Merely another servant doing his job. Nothing unusual, even if lunch came early today. Timber exulted in the rhythm of hope as Venli pushed her hand into the stone. It felt good, warm and enveloping. Unlike what happened with the deepest ones, Venli displaced the rock. It became as creme in her fingers, soft to the touch. She wasn't expert enough to get it to move on its own into the shapes she wanted. It usually did what it wanted in those cases, such as forming the tiny statues on the floor above. So for now, she simply pushed her hand forward until it hit air on the other side. Then she pressed with her other hand and pulled the two apart, forming an opening straight through the stone, the normally hard rock curling and bunching up before her touch. A surprised set of human eyes appeared at the other end of the foot-long hole, looking through at her.
"I'm going to get you out," Venli whispered to the rhythm of pleading. "But you have to promise you won't tell anyone what I've done. You won't tell them about the powers I'm using. Not even other Radiants. They think I'm cutting you out with a shard blade."
"What are you?"
the human whispered in Alethi.
"Promise me."
"Fine, promise done. Hurry, the guards are eating and they didn't even share none of it."
Venli continued shoving aside the stone. It took a ton of light. And Timber pulsed to consolation, Apparently, she thought Venli's efforts crude, lacking finesse and skill. Well, it did the job. She managed to form a hole big enough for the human girl. When Venli let go of the stone, it hardened instantly. She had to shake a few chips of it free of her fingers. The girl poked it, then hopped through. Hopefully, the guards would assume a human stone ward had survived and saved the girl. Venli gestured for the edge dancer to follow her, but the girl wavered. She seemed as if she was going to bolt away in another direction. "Please," Venli said. "We need you to save a life. If you run now, he'll die." "Who?" "Storm-blessed," Venli said. "Please, hurry with me."
"You're one of them," the girl said. "How'd you get radiant powers?"
"I am not radiant," Venli said. "I have powers from the fused that are like radiant powers. I'm a friend of Relaine, the listener who was a bridgeman. Please, I wouldn't free you only to put you in danger, but we need to go now." The girl cocked her head, then nodded for Venli to go first. The edge dancer followed on silent feet, sticking to the shadows.